Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Today we talk about blood type and aging. First, it's Dr. Peter DiDamo. He's the guy who came up with a strategy for nutrition based on your blood type. This concept is now several decades old and encompasses the work of two generations of doctors. Dr. DiDamo has updated his book to include some of the new genetic understanding since he first wrote the book 20 years ago.
Fascinating stuff, by the way. I talked to him while you were out on assignment last week or so, and looking forward.
When did I have an assignment last week?
I think you had a Sundance assignment last week. So I spoke to him in the wee hours of the morning when Sundance goers aren't, functioning.
That was the assignment. That,
that's right. But really interesting stuff. So stay tuned for that. Then we'll talk about a revolutionary approach to living young, healthier, longer. Why is it that people of the same age often appear to have aged at different rates? Do they, or is it just our perception? We take a dive into the science of aging in the telomere effect with Nobel Prize winner Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these words.
This is Danny Warner, owner of Chateau Recovery, and proud to sponsor The Mountain Life on KPCW. Chateau Recovery, helping adults with substance abuse issues build a new life through acceptance, perspective, and empowerment. Information available at 866-808-4160 or chateaurecovery.com. Addiction is a disease. Recovery is a choice.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchard from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host, Tim Henney. Well, 20 years ago, Dr. Peter DiDamo proposed a radical idea that blood type is the key that unlocks the door to the mysteries of health, disease, longevity, physical vitality, and even emotional strength. With an avalanche of diet fads and advice available all over, things like, you know, meat is bad, fish is good, fat will kill you, Dr. DiDamo proposed an entirely new way of eating and living. It's a personalized approach to holistic health based on your blood type and a new understanding of genetics. He's back 20 years later with an updated version of his book, which actually hasn't changed that much, just includes some of the things that we've been faced with in our diet and our health more recent years. I spoke with him last week, and happy to air that interview. Dr. DiDamo, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I have to start with a story back in 1996 when you first came out with Eat Right for Your Type. I didn't know what my blood type was. And so I went to the beginning of each of your chapters, and I looked through the different descriptions of what of sort of personality and type of exercise and tendencies, and I decided that I was a type B based on your description. And later on, I found out that indeed I was a type B. So that gave me all kinds of belief and gave you all kinds of credibility.
Not only is that a particularly good guess, it's a particularly odd guess, considering that they're only about 9% of the population. So you really picked a blood type with only a 10% chance of getting it right through a random method.
Oh, and I didn't know that either. Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And also around that time, a friend of mine, well, had passed me the book, and he had been this very athletic person who just seemed to carry, you know, more weight. He just had what seemed to be a different body type. And going through your diet, he had knocked off about 20 pounds and became a completely different, very lean athlete now. So it was all very interesting then. That was my first exposure to your book. And so I'm curious, first of all, let's talk about the basis for eating right for your blood type. Where does it come from?
Well, the original idea was my father's, and he pioneered this association back in the 1950s when it was more of a physical look at people. In other words, we didn't have a lot of genes back then that you could, you know, probe. I mean, we didn't have that technology. So he was looking for a way that he could somehow or another compartmentalize, to put people in different categories and then observe if there were any differences if they were given different types of diets. And then in the 1980s, when I went to medical school, I kind of reexamined the theory because it was really observational on his part. He didn't really have a basis to it in the sense that there was any sort of underpinnings that we could relate to technically. And so then I discovered that actually if I went into the medical libraries, that there were an inordinate number of studies that looked at blood groups in a way beyond what we were being taught in medical school. In medical school, you learn that they're transfusion consequences, basically, but nothing more. And here were these studies that were showing, wow, this blood type gets more peptic ulcers than another blood type. This blood type gets more heart disease. And there is just a whole separate literature that was being completely sort of ignored because they were observations that were just taking place, but they had no contextual basis. Nobody had thought to think, did they describe a pattern of sorts? And so I was just amazed, you know, that there was this incredible vocabulary here that just had never existed elsewhere. And so, you know, by the time it turned into the Eat Right book in the late 1990s, you were looking at, you know, a lot of diets, one size fits all, first low fat, then high protein, and low carb. And then here was a diet that was saying, well, no, they're all probably pretty good diets, especially if you can pin down a person who's best suited to one of those or the other. And that really became the kind of breakthrough moment for me. And now, you know, we look at the last 10 years is largely the age of genetics and genomics, and we now, nobody would debate that there's genetic influences on our diet, and yet at its very basis, you know, when we look at blood type and its effects on diet and digestion, we're really looking at the effect of genes.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Peter D'Adamo. He's written a book, well, revised and updated a book that he wrote 20 years ago called Eat Right for Your Type, the Individualized Blood Type Diet Solution. So this is one of the themes, especially digestion and how the food ends up affecting you within digestion and the sort of fatigue that we feel after eating. If you talk a little bit about each blood type, or maybe we should start with the most common blood type.
Well, that would be type O, at least in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And they're about 44% of the population. Sometimes it's good to describe type O by kind of also comparing it to its polar opposite, which is largely type A, which comprises 40% of the population. So between type O and type A, you're really looking at about 8 out of 10 people, 9 out of 10 people.
Yeah.
That's why your guess that you were blood type B was so good.
Mm-hmm.
The O, or, and I, you know, again, this is, I'll use a family member. My wife is type O. I'm a type A. The most significant difference in digestion is that she possesses enzymes in her digestive tract that break down fat and are responsible for the processing of proteins. The level of these enzymes are 4.5 to 5 times greater in her by her blood type than they are in me. So, for instance, my type O wife is ideally suited for a more of a low-carb, paleo, high-protein type diet. And me, type A, I don't really have any of those capacities. Those enzyme levels are just not there. So typically, if I overindulge in those things, I will feel consequences. And then the consequences are both short-term and long-term, because if you look at the probable people who are most impacted by that standard American diet of the typical amount of protein and fat and things, it's type A, because they're not suited for that. And so it's no surprise if you go back now to like the 1950s, they were doing research showing that there were huge differences in heart disease and coronary artery disease and stroke, that blood type A had at times 2 times greater risk of these things than blood type O. So you can see that it's really the blood type that would be most negatively impacted by the standard American diet.
Right.
So what do? Mr. Type A, I lean more towards an Asian/Mediterranean diet, more plant-based, a little bit. So really, there's the magic of the theory. There's the fork in the road for 85% of the population. If you're type O, you go this way, high protein, low carb, paleo. And if you're type A, you go that way, Mediterranean, you know, Asian kind of thing.
Yeah.
Now we'll get to the B's, like my esteemed interviewer. And you have a much difficult time categorizing it. They don't categorize as easily as, you know, you go that way and you go that way. And that's because one of the interesting links between blood group and diet is that there are proteins in the foods themselves that interact with the blood groups that happen to line your digestive tract. Mm-hmm. So even though people know that a blood type is, most people know that it's something that's on a red blood cell that, you know, is immunologically marks it as a certain blood type. Turns out that very same chemical lines your digestive tract. It's in all your mucus. It's in your semen if you're a man. It's in your vaginal secretions if you're a woman. It's in your perspiration. It's in your saliva. It's all over the place. It turns out that the lining of your digestive tract is as unique to you by virtue of your blood type as the red blood cells in your bloodstream. So looking at it from that perspective, you can see that there are interactions that occur with certain foods and the lining of the digestive tract on a molecular level that vary from blood group to blood group. And so these molecules, they actually can interact with the lining of the digestive tract in a way where they cause damage in one blood type and leave the other blood type completely unmolested. Hmm. And so if you're blood type B, you want to get a list of the foods that are going to interact with your digestive tract. But it turns out that the list isn't really, it's not easy to categorize. You know, you can't go low fat, high protein. You just have to go idiosyncratic list of things you should not eat if you're blood group B. Or even better, here are the things that you should eat if you're blood group B. You know, so I've always described your blood type as just very idiosyncratic. You know, you have to really go food by food and see which ones best agree with you. A perfect example of this is that, you know, turkey, which is a commonly eaten food, and chicken, which is a commonly eaten food. Turkey is generally well processed by blood group B, and chicken is not, even though most people would tend to think, you know, these things are pretty similar. What could be the distinction here? But chickens have a chemical that reacts with the lining of people who are blood type B, and turkey doesn't.
That's fascinating. It's funny. I just remember that I've carried this one food through since 1996, which is tomatoes. I've never loved tomatoes. I mean, who doesn't love tomatoes? Tomato sauce never has appealed to me. And I just, you know, now I don't fight it. I just say, well, maybe it's just not right for my type.
You know, the curious thing about this diet is that, you know, the diet books always come out in January because everybody's going to try to lose weight, right?
Right.
So here's big diet book month. The funny part is that the vast majority of the reason why this theory has had such a long history is not by people losing weight. It's by people who eat this way in order to be able to control some disease they have.
Uh-huh.
And think about it. If a lot of your immune system is located in your gut, and a lot of the foods that are interacting with the immune system in your gut are predictable in their actions by knowing your blood type, you have a powerful influence on how effective your immune system is going to work throughout your body by just programming and reprogramming how you eat.
That's fascinating.
And so you can,
go ahead.
No, sorry. I think the important thing is that, you know, people will say, well, we're going to look at your book and put people on diet for a week and see how they do. And it's like, well, okay, you're going to probably take a couple of healthy interns and put them on a diet for a week and then see that nothing happened. And the reality is that, you know, if you're healthy and you follow this for a week, you know, probably nothing will happen. But then again, they don't make many drugs that work in a week either. It's just a very unrealistic expectation. But if you're a person who has an illness, irritable bowel disease, or mm-hmm. any number of different hormonal things, thyroid things, you can change the course of the expression of that disease over the course in time. And there's no better evidence of this than the numerous times that people have said, you know, I read your book and the thing that convinced me that it had value was that I know that the things that you say not to eat, I've discovered on my own before I even read your book that they were making my illness worse.
That's fascinating. My guest is Dr. Peter D'Adamo. He's written Eat Right for Your Type, a book published first 20 years ago, and it's been revised and updated. We're talking about the foods you eat and how they will be reflected depending upon your blood type. When we talk about digestive health, I'm thinking of, you know, some of the current trends right now in our food and the way that we live. And we talk about how gut health is the end-all be-all to prevent disease and all the probiotics and the things that we take to increase the gut health. It makes me think that if people followed what you're talking about, for starters, you're not really fighting so much of an uphill battle, right?
You know, that's such a provocative point, and it really led to the reason why I had to write the revised version of the book. It turned out that in the 20 years since the first book was written, there have been a lot of interesting associations that have occurred in addition with regard to blood type, and one of them has to do with something called your microbiome.
Right.
And the microbiome is all the bugs inside of you, right? There's something like 10 trillion of these things. And we're now discovering that these things control our neurotransmitters, they control our levels of inflammation, they control our rate of metabolism. And it turns out that the single biggest predictor of the particular types of bacteria in your microbiome is your blood type. So actually, one of the things we're discovering is that bacteria like an environment, like remember what I said, if I'm blood type A, my blood type A chemical is in my digestive tract. Turns out bacteria have a preference for certain of these things. So for instance, bacteria, you know, this bacteria might like to basically metabolize my blood type chemical. It'll have a nicer time inside of me. It might not grow that well in my wife. And there was a study that was done that showed that there were bacteria differences of certain bacteria were 50,000 times more likely to grow in one blood type than another. So we're now going to, so that's why the whole revision came into place. I wanted to just incorporate the fact that there was this whole other world of associations that had occurred in 20 years with regard to blood type that, you know, I could have never even guessed 20 years ago.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so that was a question I was going to get to about the revision and how much has it changed?
Well, you know, I have to say one thing. In the 20 years, I've had to change actually very little of the conclusions,
mm-hmm.
which is, I think, a testimony to the veracity of the information. If you look at any of the other diet books, and I'm not here to disparage them, but the very ultra-low-fat people from the 1980s have all modulated. Okay, now they all eat some salmon. And then the very ultra-low-carb people from the 1990s have all modulated. Now they eat a little of this, it's a little bit more balanced. So everybody gradually morphs with information that kind of conflicts with their initial premise. But very little of the conclusions that I drew 20 years ago had to be changed at all. I only had to integrate the fact that there was an entirely new series of observances that I couldn't have included in the first book because they were not available.
Pretty fascinating. Talk a little bit about things, you know, again, you know, trending now in dietary choices and necessity, really, things like celiac disease. Are things like celiac disease tied to blood type?
Well, that's a great question. There is, as far as I can tell, I don't think there's been any studies that have shown a greater precedence of celiac disease and blood type,
mm-hmm.
because classic celiac disease is actually a genetic thing that is really independent of your blood type. But let's look at the people who go gluten-free, who have an improvement in their health, but probably don't have celiac disease.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right, because what's the first thing when you have celiac disease? They say, well, no more gluten for you.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the people who don't have celiac disease but then notice that their arthritis gets better or their skin clears up when they do go gluten-free?
A lot of people.
So obviously there's a third criteria. There's a third classification here. People who don't have celiac disease but improve on a gluten-free diet. Now, the interesting thing about gluten is that if you look, if you remember early part in this interview, I said there were things in foods that react on a molecular level with the lining of the digestive tract in a way that you can predict knowing your blood type. Many of those reactants are commonly found in foods that are also high gluten foods. So that when somebody says, I went gluten-free and feel fabulous, even though they don't have celiac disease, it may not have been the gluten avoidance that produced it. It was the avoidance of these other chemicals that were interacting directly with their digestive tract. There's a class of chemicals called lectins, which are little protein molecules that glom onto your mucus of your digestive tract. And you know, they're very lock and key. For instance, a food that has a lectin that would attach to my digestive tract would slide off my wife's, because my digestive tract has a different molecule than hers, right? I'm type A, she's type O. So, you know, there's a lot of things that, you know, I kind of look at a little bit askance and think, you know, everybody poo-poos the whole gluten thing, because obviously not everybody who gets improvement from a gluten-free diet could have celiac disease, but there are people, considerable numbers, who feel better going gluten-free. But in many respects, one could argue that maybe they were just going free of the lectin that was also in the food that was causing them problems, and they were associating with gluten because, you know, everybody knows about gluten, but who's ever heard of a lectin?
Right. Oh, that's pretty interesting. So it all seems to make such sense to me. What are your detractors saying, or what's the naysaying surrounding this?
Well, you know, I think the naysaying is that there's just there's this sort of incredulousness of the fact that something can be this phantasmagorical. And I think that comes from essentially the notion, as I said early on, that if your entire education about blood groups is that they're a transfusion phenomenon and they exist inside your bloodstream, and you're unaware of all the other distributions and all the other body tissues, and somebody's saying, well, your blood type has an influence on your diet, you can't make the connection because you don't have the necessary information. So you wind up in a situation, and medical and scientific people are renowned, you know, I mean, I'm one of them, for, well, you know, how could that possibly be given the fact that I know everything there is to know about everything in the world, and it makes completely nonsense or whatever. The reality is anytime you ever sit down and have a discussion and realize that ultimately there is everything based upon all this prior research, it's very difficult. You know, the notion is that, like I said, when I first heard this from my father, I thought it was crazy because there was nothing in my education that would prepare me to make a link between blood groups and diet. Okay, I had to discover that there was an entire world of information that nobody paid any attention to. Okay, so that's the most common type of thing, which is just the generalized scientific skepticism, and that can usually be rectified by, you know, just basically sharing information. And then you have the dog-eat-dog world of diets. I mean, you know, everybody who's got a diet book out has got problems with everybody else's diet book. So, and, you know, the interesting thing is you can put a low-fat guy on a low-carb guy on a talk show, and they'll just go at it, you know. And the reality is that, you know, they are two opposing viewpoints of the same thing. But, you know, the reality is that the one diet that I think they both would agree that they have trouble with would be my diet, because essentially, the theory kind of makes a subset out of both of them. And, you know, nobody wants to be a subset of someone else's diet theory. So, you know, the one thing they could probably agree on is that, you know, they both don't have a place in their heart for me, because I'm just saying, well, they're both right. All the diet theories are correct, and you try to figure out, you know, what are the types of things that you're dealing with. What's the type of person you're dealing with? What's the specifics of the person? Now, we're in the age of nutrigenomics, which is the idea that genes and diet and nutrition are linked. And so, you know, the idea gets a whole lot less resistant because the paradigm is shifting. People are now starting to go, oh, yes, there are variations in people genetically between what they would benefit from and what they would be harmed by. So, you know, sometimes you just have to wait it out and let the paradigm shift do its work. But the interesting thing is that typically, as I said before, you know, I mean, I've written scientific papers of daunting complexity that nobody's read. And yet, you know, when I write a book that's a mass market thing, all of a sudden everybody's got their theories about its validity. But, you know, one should really use the more complicated information that's been available over the years to make decisions, not something that's on a shelf in a bookstore that's written for the general public. That's a whole different message.
Right.
And it took me a while as a scientist to wrap my head around the fact that, you know, that's a different writing style than you use in science. You know, in science, everything is very telegraphic.
Right.
You know, just the facts, ma'am. And when you write a mass market book, that all changes. I mean, you know, when I first wrote the book 20 years ago, I handed in the first manuscript. They turned it back to me. They said, nobody's going to read this. You know, and they said, you know, that's not what we want. We want a book that people can enjoy reading, that they can, you know, grasp. I'm very proud of the book for what it did, which is succeed on a mass market level, but be very odd to think that that's the limit of the science, something that's in a shelf in the Barnes & Noble.
Exactly. Well, the book is Eat Right for Your Type, the Individualized Blood Type Diet Solution. My guest is Dr. Peter D'Adamo, and I'm so glad that you could join us this morning. Thank you.
My pleasure, Lynn. Nice chatting with you. Wonderful interview. Thank you.
Oh, take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be right back after these words. Stay with us. It's The Mountain Life.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
Josh Carr here, Membership Director at Park Meadows Country Club, sponsor of KPCW. Park Meadows offers an 18-hole Jack Nicklaus golf course, weekly ski groups, on-mountain club including parking and locker room at Chateau Deer Valley, cross-country skiing, fine dining, and fitness center. Golf and social memberships available at 649-2460 or on the web.
Experience the ride of a lifetime on the Comet bobsled ride at the Utah Olympic Park. Our professional pilots take passengers on a thrilling ride down the 2002 Olympic track. In less than a mile, you'll rip through curves, hitting top speeds like an Olympic athlete. It's adrenaline rush not to be missed. Reservations required. Details and restrictions are available online at UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a KPCW supporter and a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, we all age, and when we take the time to look closely at the process of aging, it becomes apparent that there are obvious differences to how people age, thus raising the question, is there healthy aging, and can humans live a full and alert life right up to the end? Turns out, how we choose to live both inwardly and outwardly, individually and collectively, informs how our genes express themselves and has a significant impact on longevity, wellness, and health. And now, there's science to prove it. The co-author of a new book called The Telomere Effect, A Revolutionary Approach to Living Younger, Healthier, Longer, is Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, who won a Nobel Prize for her work on discovering the telomerase and telomere role in the aging process. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to The Mountain Life, Dr. Blackburn.
Thank you.
Wonderful to have you. First of all, why don't you take us... It's not often we get to talk to a Nobel Prize winner. You won the Nobel Prize in 2009, along with another handful of scientists, directly related to this work on telomere. Take us through what you discovered with the work, quickly.
Yes. Well, I and my two co-laureates had made discoveries which were really basic science of what's at the end of chromosomes. And if you, here's a way to think about it. If you think of shoelaces, we can think of shoelaces as being chromosomes which carry all our genes. And if you think about your shoelaces, they have little tips that protect the ends. And if you don't have those tips intact, the ends start fraying away. The shoelaces don't work. Well, you know, our body is filled with tiny shoelaces, so to speak. And those are our chromosomes carrying our genetic material. And the telomeres are those protective tips, and they have a tendency overall in our lives to wear down over the decades of life. And when that happens, cells can't work properly. And when they can't work properly, that is one of the things that contributes to the many processes going on in aging. But this is one of them, because the cells don't replenish themselves properly, they don't work properly, and that in turn, there's good science showing that that in turn leads to the sorts of changes that increase risks of the major diseases that mark the ends of our health span, which is the years we live in our life healthy. And when you have telomeres getting too short, your chances of getting things like cardiovascular disease, even diabetes, some of the mini cancers, lung diseases, poor immune function, they all go up because the parts of your body throughout your body are not working properly. So this is all quantifiable, but the science that led to it was very basic science, saying, let's try and understand what is it that's protecting the ends of our chromosomes, what's protecting our genes. And that's what we've discovered, was the telomeres and the enzyme telomerase, which was a way that the cells have of partially replenishing those ends, but it's a very complex process as well.
I find it so interesting, Dr. Blackburn, that you have spent a lot of your career in academic settings, no doubt, in many, many labs for many weeks upon months upon years. And there must be something about this particular research that made you want to, that compelled you to present a book that is digestible for the masses.
Yes, well, what had happened was that the basic science had grown into a very thorough understanding of what's going on with the molecules and cells. But then the question was, how does it play out in humans? And so with studies that started actually with my co-author, Elissa Epple, a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UCSF, where I was until just last year when I became president of the Salk Institute in California. But for all those decades, as you referred to, I have been doing research as a professor in the University of California system. And we decided that we really didn't know what sorts of things might affect telomere maintenance that were things that are important in people's lives. And a real focus initially, and still is what sorts of things does severe chronic stress of all different kinds do to our telomere maintenance? And to our surprise, we found it was very quantifiable. And then, of course, we wanted to understand, and many around the world now, you know, really have, you know, there's hundreds of research papers on this now, what are the kinds of factors that also have good effects on your telomeres? And so we wanted to put this all together, because it's all over the place in all sorts of different scientific journals, lots of replicated studies, put them together into useful information that people can see has a real underlying basis based on real, you know, data, real understanding of some of this biology. And so people can use it in usable ways to change their lives, not to be sort of a fad for this year where you do some extreme thing, but to incorporate the kinds of findings in ways that are doable so that you can have long-lasting effects on this particular one effect that's going on during aging.
Dr. Blackburn, I wanted to ask you a question about the science that you were discussing and that illustration you use about the chromosome being like a shoelace with the protective tip. What was it that allowed the science and your science to actually look at the chromosome in such a way and discover the protective tip? Was it not looked at before or not understood, or is there some, you know, medical tool or some imaging process that is part of a technological development that allowed for it?
Absolutely. So that's how science advances. What had been known about chromosome ends was that you could look under the microscope and you could see kind of blobs there, and you knew that if something was disrupted, nobody knew what the telomere was, then the genes wouldn't be inherited properly. The chromosomes wouldn't work properly. That was known from the 30s. That didn't tell us anything about it. Then in the 70s, the very dawn of DNA sequencing began. You know, now we're completely familiar with whole genomes being sequenced. But then it was just the beginning. And so right away that I realized, this gave me a foothold on something never to be looked at before, which is chromosome ends. And I chose a little funny creature that lives in ponds and swims around. and it's a single-celled organism, but it happens to have tens of thousands of tiny, tiny, very short chromosomes, and they're linear. So, you know, that means lots of ends. So now I could use the molecular tools that were now being developed to say, let's look directly at the ends. Now we have, you know, many, many more tools, but as soon as a technological tool like that becomes available, you know, it's wonderful because it opens up all sorts of new questions that you can actually ask. And that's what I discovered, that this was very, you know, interesting DNA at the ends. No one had any idea it would be like this. And then discovered this completely new enzyme called telomerase that nobody had any idea how DNA ends could actually be replenished. That the enzyme actually adds extra telomeric DNA onto the ends and sort of bulks up those little tips. So it was absolutely, as you say, it was technological advances from the molecular biology world that got us there. It, you know, imaging had just given us microscopy, and that hadn't given any kind of clue as to the real nature of what was going on. It was molecular techniques. And now, of course, we combine them in all sorts of exciting ways in modern research.
So I'm curious about what kind of happens for you as a scientist when you have these new technologies that allow you to actually connect the dots between things that have sort of been understood at a more, you know, from the perspective of meditation is good for us and stress is bad for us and eating healthy is good for us, and we've sort of assumed, or some people have accepted that, and some cultures and societies have really organized around those principles. And then as a scientist, you're now able to go, and the science is proving these things out. Do you ever just slap your forehead and go, holy cow, not just because you discovered something really amazing, but because you've connected those dots to these existing practices?
You've got it exactly. It was such an exciting thing, and many people really found that connection, that something that seems very concrete, very molecular, you know, how much is, you know, how much DNA is there on our telomeres at the ends of our chromosomes, you know, to something that is a much more kind of macro whole person kind of experience. And of course, there's a whole lot of complexity in between, but somehow those two different kinds of realities, you know, as you said, it's endlessly fascinating, and that's what biology is. You know, we are marvelously, endlessly fascinating things, we humans, and how our minds work, but and particularly how our minds affect our bodies. That was a real impetus for writing the book, because it was one way of seeing, yes, of course we know our minds affect our bodies. You know, we're afraid, our hearts beat faster, our stomach churns. You know, we know that kind of thing. But to see it being played out in these real long-term ways that really add up to big impacts on people's health over the years, that has been just a, you know, marvelous journey made by many, many people. I mean, this is not me alone. Of course, this is whole fields. People interested in different questions, as you say, meditation, what about, you know, how is the life I lead in terms of, you know, my social environment and things like that. And playing this against this kind of way of looking at it has just, you know, it's just opened up all these doors, which will continue to be giving us, I think, good insights into what can be usefully done. And this is one kind of way to gauge how to usefully change, you know, things that mightn't be ideal. You know, what's working, what doesn't work, how much exercise do you really need? It's one way of looking at it.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Nobel Prize-winning scientist Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn. She's the president of the Salk Institute in Southern California. She's co-written a new book called The Telomere Effect, A Revolutionary Approach to Living Younger, Healthier, Longer. And I'm wondering, Elizabeth, if there's... I was trying to think of someone who lived a really long life for perhaps no good reason other than he had bulked up telomeres on the ends of his chromosomes.
Well, it that will be a part of it. It's, yeah. But it's not the whole reason that people live to be centenarians, and that's under an intense study, of course. There are many aspects of aging. There are many mechanisms going on. This is the one that I think is the one to think about that allow you to get through to those good years. In fact, we do find that those who do live to be centenarians, let me tell you, on average, their telomeres are longer So the telomeres in the general population drift down over the decades. There's ups and downs, and there's quite interesting predictions that comes from those. But the people who are centenarians, if you look at them average, then you look at the population at the time of maximum mortality, which is in the 70s, those in the 70s have shorter telomeres. Now, we wouldn't say that's cause and effect, excepting there's a whole lot of now genetic information that tells us the common variations in genes that are dedicated to telomere maintenance statistically affect whether you get things like cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's. And these are the big things that come up with age. And so we want to understand how this aspect of biology is helping us at least stave those things off so that those of us lucky enough to live, you know, to be 100 do. And those are other reasons. But at least, you know, their chances are they're not going to be filled by these much, much more common reasons for mortality in the population.
So take us through some of the things that have surprised you. For example, you know, we know if we read your book that it's diet, lifestyle, reduction of stress. What has most surprised you about something that improves those the bulking up or the bolstering of the telomeres?
Well, I think the way you can beat telomeres up, and they integrate a lot of different things. One thing that really struck me was that people who are under, you know, some sort of chronic severe stress, when you looked at if they exercised or simply were sedentary, even doing like 10, 15 minutes of, you know, quite sort of brisk exercise like walking per day was enough to alleviate the attrition on telomeres that would have happened otherwise because of the stress-related things. There's quantitative relationships with the degree and severity and also how people deal with stresses and telomere shortening. And that shows up really much in sedentary people, but those who exercise a bit, just this kind of average exercise I mentioned, that was much alleviated. And in fact, having, you know, doing exercise for the bang for the buck for the exercise, you know, is sort of twice as good as it is, it turns out, quantitatively, for those under severe chronic stress than for those who are not stressed. So exercise is fine for those who are not stressed, of course, but it's actually extra helpful. So to me, it was like the very time when a lot of people think, oh, you know, getting a little exercise is the last thing I feel like doing when you're chronically stressed. Here was the kind of readout of a way of assessing that actually it might be particularly useful. The other thing that struck me, I'll give you two, was that we were very impressed by the fact that so many things that are in our outside world, you know, starting with relationships and, you know, being under domestic abuse situations and so on, quantifiably related to telomere shortness, you know, quantifiably. So it's an objective measure. And then things like being in situations where people are experiencing severe discrimination, particularly racial discrimination, being in situations where the neighborhood quality is, you know, demonstrably worse and worse, the telomeres are shorter and shorter, despite correcting for all of the other obvious things that might have explained this away. So the impact, as you'd referred to earlier, of our minds, you know, how our minds are, you know, what's going on, is quantifiably read out in this telomere relationship, and that in turn is related to real statistical risks for these diseases, you know, the big ones that kill us as we age, mostly. So those things surprised me. How much effect, you know, something like, you know, even social policy might have on something that we can quantify, and then, you know, say this is going to have, you know, effects overall to how we think of our public health overall. You know, what's going to be happening to us as a population.
You know, I can't help but wonder about, again, just as an observation, we talk to a lot of people, and a common theme that seems to be more and more prevalent is that science, well, these two alternate realities that you mentioned before, being societal influences or practices, and then science, which is connecting very and proving out these, you know, thousands of year old practices in some ways, There seems to be a wave of that, and I'm not sure if it's just because of this radio show and sort of our theme being lifestyle, health, nutrition, education, which focuses us on that, or if there's really something happening here with the development of the technology that we talked about a moment ago, which has created this enormous wave of the ability to connect science with cultural and societal practice. Do you see that, or is it just a matter of perception?
Well, I think what science is always helping provide is you know, as best one can, objective measures, right? And that gives one something to ground things in. And I think, you know, when you get that way of adding to the insights that come from other ways of regarding things, it's a very useful and, you know, true way of getting some kind of grasp of something. And so, you know, it's not that one diminishes the other or anything like that. I think, you know, we're humans are infinitely curious. We do want to know how things work. And there are many ways of perceiving that and understanding that. And science is one particular way that has, you know, the best chance sometimes of getting at, you know, what is real, because one can build in ways of making it you know, objective and stand the test of, you know, being torn apart or not. And so it gives you a good basis for things and understanding of them. I mean, I think understanding one of the many processes that's going on in our body and just sort of understanding that better, you know, to me is very enriching to know ourselves better. This is just one facet of it.
Well, then I have to ask you this. I was tempted not to, but I'm going to have to. I was watching an interview just the other night, and a commentator made an observation relative to our current situation, political situation in the United States, and said, I'm not going to call out names, but said, you know, there are people in leadership roles who believe a lot of things that aren't true. And here you are as a scientist, trying to prove and create and provide a basis of truthful understanding. And we are in a current environment where people can choose to believe things that aren't true. How does that influence you?
Yes, it's obviously always been of concern through history when this kind of, you know, when reality is sort of bent to various ends. And again, when one has a way of thinking, at least scientifically, you know, it's a way of thinking as well. And it's a way of organizing, you know, your thoughts as to, well, you know, what do I really know about this? What is the evidence? What's the evidence that might, you know, undercut that? Can I see that it's still robust to that? So I think it provides a good way of critical thinking that, you know, does from time to time in history become especially important, and now would be such a time. So I think we, you know, thinking scientifically sounds very unapproachable to people, but it isn't really. It's just thinking in ways that you don't just accept something. You say, well, really, let me think about this. You know, I've got a brain too. I can think about this. Does this make sense? And then, you know, trying to understand the nature of the evidence from which, you know, say a policy will be built. This is a very good basis on which to at least start, you know, to get to a foundation. Of course, there'll be other considerations. So, yes, I think we're concerned, and I think, you know, scientists do have, you know, a sort of sense that you really make true progress when you have got to the truth of something. Because, you know, if you're making it up, it's not going to get you far in understanding how, you know, how science, how the material world works, which is what science is about. But great. We are part of the material world.
Yes, great answer. I wanted to ask you, kind of shifting away from that.
Yes, I feel like I'm in my qualifying exam because you're asking such good penetrating questions.
Oh, good. We wouldn't want you to just rest on your laurels now, would we?
Not at all. Never do that.
All right. So I wanted to ask you about the effects of things like cortisol on the telomere. As we know that, you know, cortisol, the release of cortisol, you know, comes with added stress in our lives, and you know, just wanted to get
around the science of that and the things that actually, you know, deteriorate those little shoelace tips, as you call them?
Well, it's quite informative because, you know, from what I've learned about the world of stress research, and it's a very extensive research area, and cortisol is just hormone that, you know, is something that is one of the many stress hormone responses. You know, it's a complex set. But if you just look at the one, and then which is cortisol, and you could say, well, actually, you know, we're made to have a burst of cortisol when there's an acute stress, and that's good. But the burst should go up, and then it should go back down again, you know, as we deal with acute stress. But with chronic stress, what happens is that it never really goes back down, doesn't have a chance to go back down again after the stress is finished. And then the response to a real acute stress is sort of blunted, and so the level of cortisol is always staying higher overall. So it's not only the level... it's actually the dynamics of it going up and down don't work properly in chronically stressed people. So now imagine you've got your cells bathed with something which is mostly higher cortisol. And so people have looked inside immune cells, which is where we get a lot of our window into how telomeres are being maintained, and they find that such cells, if they're bathed in cortisol, they don't maintain their telomeres as well. And you can see that, actually, you know, really related to how much cortisol there is. So that's one, you know, it's very satisfying to see one kind of direct mechanism, you know, from the brain, which is influencing cortisol and these patterns I just talked about, to, wow, it's not really maintaining the telomeres properly. Now, there are lots and lots of, you know, hundreds of molecules involved in that, right? Mm-hmm. We have very complex cells. But you can see in the end there's that result. But we shouldn't say it's the only thing going on, because everything going on in our body is going on in the context of all the other complex processes. But this is one example of it's a dysregulation more than, you know, simply being high or simply being low. But it certainly has the effect on telomere maintenance that we can see over the short-term period that you can look at cells, you know, as you culture them in the laboratory, you can see that effect. And you can see it even in cells taken freshly from people who are volunteers, participants in studies, looking at, you know, what's the physiology of people, you know, in various stressful situations. So it's a very, you know, cortisol has been much, much studied.
Yeah.
And you know, how one uses that information is not really clear, but there's a better understanding of it now.
Right, right. Our guest is Nobel Prize-winning scientist Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn. She's co-written the book with Dr. Alyssa Eppel. It's called The Telomere Effect, A Revolutionary Approach to Living Younger, Healthier, and Longer. And we're so glad you could join us today. A fascinating discussion. This is great stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back after this.
The Utah Legislature meets for 6 weeks from the end of January till mid-March, and KPCW News will cover all major developments affecting the Wasatch Back and you. Reports from Capitol Hill and your lawmakers are brought to you by Tesh Law, real estate, trusts and estates, and general litigation since 1989. TeshLaw.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
We want to thank our underwriters, the doctors at the Park City Specialty Clinic, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Park Meadows Country Club, Park City Mountain, Chateau Recovery.